This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to The Spectator Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Emma Smith, who is the Professor of Shakespeare Studies at Oxford and has written a new book called This Is Shakespeare, which is out imminently from Pelican Books. Emma, welcome. Now, there seems to be a sort of a very Shakespearean paradox almost immediately, because you've given your book this extremely indicative title, This Is Shakespeare, and yet it's a book actually about the indeterminacy of Shakespeare, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. And in fact, I tried to have a go at saying maybe we should turn Shakespeare from a noun into a verb, and to think that the This Is Shakespeare of my title is actually about an approach to the works rather than the works as monumental. But you're absolutely right. There is a kind of paradox in there. And I'm sort of trying to undo that sense that Shakespeare's on a pedestal.
You use the word gappiness to describe the kind of distinctive quality of Shakespeare. Can you say what do you mean by gappiness?
So by gappiness, I mean all kinds of indeterminacy in Shakespeare, and that goes from relatively small-scale texture plays. All plays of this period, but Shakespeare particularly, are not telling us anything other than what the characters say. So we don't know anything about how they say it that isn't encoded in the speech. We don't know anything about the actions they're taking. So there are very few, relatively few stage directions in Shakespeare, and there are no descriptive stage directions at all. So there's a kind of openness there, there's a gap there, that the sort of choreography of the plays is very much open to interpretation. And then there are other kinds of conceptual gaps, I suppose. I'm not writing a kind of historical account of Shakespeare, but I am interested in a Shakespeare who gets the energy of his works from having one foot either side of quite a big historical shift or a big divide, from a broadly providentialist, religious, broadly kind of medieval view of sort of causation and the world, to something we would associate with Machiavelli and Hobbes that's more human-centred, and that question of, you know, why things happen. There seems a gap between different sort of theories of the world, which I think he's also exploring. So some of the gaps are sort of technical but have interpretive consequences, and some are more philosophical, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say some of the technical gaps you describe, you know, the characters aren't described and so forth, seem to be, you know, very hardly unique to Shakespeare. I mean, aren't they something that every play pretty much has in common? I mean, you know, you might get some 20th century stage directions that says, you know, X is tall and wears an ostrich feather hat, but...
Yeah, certainly by the 20th century, you are tending to get very directive stage directions. If you look at the stage directions that Arthur Miller uses, for instance, every speech perhaps has three or four parentheses about, you know, the pace or the tone of voice, whatever. No, you're right. It's partly about the gap of reading a script. I mean, I do think in some ways Shakespeare's plays, it's helpful to think about them as scripts. That is to say, part of the toolkit you would need to put the play on, but not the whole thing, as opposed to lyric poetry or the novel, which could claim to be the whole thing itself.
You talk about Shakespeare being on a pedestal and, you know, wanting to take him off a pedestal. I mean, it also strikes me that, I remember, you know, when I was at university, when I was at school, you know, your A-levels, you'd get the rest of literature and then a special section on Shakespeare, you know, special papers on Shakespeare. You know, you're the Professor of Shakespeare Studies. There aren't very many people who have job titles like that that refer to one single writer. And, you know, what do you feel about that? I mean, do you think, because it seems to be baked into our institutions, even at an academic level where you'd think that that would be seem anti-intellectual, that there's the canon and then there's Shakespeare, that he stands completely aside from and above the rest of the canon.
I think that's a really interesting paradox about where we are with Shakespeare right now, that in some ways Shakespeare is the sort of apex of this canonical pyramid. He looks like the ultimate dead white male author who is over-invested by sort of literary history. And on the other hand, I suppose we are seeing quite a lot of that investment being kind of leveraged towards more radical or more progressive kind of readings of the plays. So there is
but
a sense of having it
both.
We're still reading the plays.
No,
that's absolutely right. I mean, if you wanted to, it's striking to me that the big experiments really about cross-racial or colorblind casting, so-called cross-gender casting, they've happened through Shakespeare, as if the content is so beyond reproach that it offers a vehicle to do something which might be a bit more controversial. So there are interesting ways that Shakespeare plays in our culture, and part of me thinks, yes, this is a kind of greedy, spoilt kind of child of the canon that's taking all the attention away from other things. And part of me thinks, well, that shared sense that we know something about what this is does enable some other kinds of readings to come in.
You mean because we've studied him so thoroughly that he becomes...
We've studied him so thoroughly. We have, you know, theatres that are going to put on his works. We have a sense of an audience who will come to the works even if something slightly different is being done with them. Some of the work of sort of publicising has already been done, and some of the sense of why this is worth doing is already hardwired into our culture. But I absolutely accept the paradox. And I guess the reason I wanted... I mean, I do teach lots of other Renaissance dramatists. I think there are some wonderful, interesting dramatists. We almost always teach those historically as products of their time and interesting commentators on their time. And although there is a strong and really interesting strand of thinking about Shakespeare historically, in some ways what interests me is that much longer history, the kind of 400-year history of keeping Shakespeare as a contemporary figure, which doesn't really... I can see that
part really
of the problem,
Kidd,
but we don't really read Kidd as now, or Webb, even Webster or Middleton or those people, yeah.
And who enshrined, do you think, I mean, or where were the major staging posts in enshrining Shakespeare, our contemporary? I mean, I guess Ben Jonson comes into it, but...
Well, Jonson's sort of eulogy for Shakespeare in the first folio of Shakespeare, so in 1623... I mean, it's a wonderful staging point. He says Shakespeare isn't not for an age, but for all time. He does actually, one of the funny things about Jonson is that he, and he acknowledges this himself, he's a bit of a renter quote, and he actually says quite a lot of people are effectively not of an age, but for all time. My favourite example of that is a person called Thomas Coriat, about whom he was almost certainly wrong. Coriat did not last. So he has a line in these puffs. Jonson writes... He writes
it's like Hilary Mantel or Lee Child of his day.
Yeah. That's a low blow, Sam, since you know that Hilary Mantel has very kindly written a blurb for my book. But you know,
oh, good God, I didn't actually.
No, quite so.
I withdraw that immediately.
Quite so. Yeah, so Jonson will do anything for money. I think he writes a great little pageant for the opening of Britain's Burs, which is essentially the opening of a shopping centre. I mean, he would be there. But yeah, Jonson is important. Jonson is... It's a slightly backhanded thing. I think Jonson is saying this isn't very fashionable, but nevertheless it will last. And there is a sense that Shakespeare has lasted, perhaps because it was never as topical as other writers' work, including Jonson's, was. There's a great point when Dryden says, you know, sort of 50 years later, I admire Jonson, but I love Shakespeare. And we start to move from a sense that Ben Jonson is a more classically informed and a more rigorous playwright, but Shakespeare is a more effective one. And there's a long history of saying, you know, Shakespeare does emotion and character, and other playwrights might construct plays more properly and with more decorum, and their language might be more decorous, but they don't get to this poet of nature kind of point. But the Shakespeare our contemporary phrase comes from the Polish theatre director and intellectual Jan Kott, writing in the early 60s, translated into English in the mid 60s, very influential on Peter Brook, Peter Hall, that new line of Royal Shakespeare Company productions, like the sort of white box Midsummer Night's Dream, really were decisive in a sort of modernist kind of Shakespeare production style.
I mean, another more recent staging post, which you seem to me to take quite strong issue with, at least implicitly, is the sort of Harold Bloom idea that people didn't really have inner lives until Shakespeare invented the idea of having inner lives for them. You're quite sceptical, I think it's fair to say, in this book, aren't you, of the idea that interiority or the sort of inner lives of the character is the important bit, or is even a bit that we aren't just reading into Shakespeare. Can you say why you do resist that so much? I mean, because people go, but soliloquies.
Mm. I do resist that. I partly resist it because there's a lot of that material already. It's very widespread. It's very mainstream in our A-level teaching. It's the kind of thing that one of the really interesting, I think, popular forms of discourse about Shakespeare comes from actors talking about performing. And I find that often, you know, really full of insight and interest. But they're really, obviously, they're playing characters. They have to make the characters like real people. And they have to make the characters really important people. One of the things that was most controversial about the edition, the RSC edition of the plays, was it gave the percentage of lines for each character. And that blew away directors, reassuring people to say, you know, you're absolutely crucial to this play. You know, obviously you've got 2% of the lines.
Yes, I think Don John has a very small part.
Yes, he does have a very small part. Boom. There's a long history of thinking that Shakespeare does character and that these are character-driven plays. And I suppose I wanted to explore something slightly different, which is less that Shakespeare writes characters first and then they do things, and more that Shakespeare inherits plots first and he writes the characters who can enact those plots. So that's a slightly different model of priority. And sometimes character sort of flaws or character gaps or character inconsistencies seem to me more the result of a slight misfit between the plot and the character than they do some sort of psychic agony or other. So, for example, the big question in Othello, which is from Coleridge onward, has been why does Iago do what he does? What's Iago's motivation? I mean, in some ways, we could take that question out of the play by saying, of course, you know, Iago is a mechanism in the plot. This is what needs to happen. It's not that his motives are too deep and too profound and too psychological to be explained. It's that they're actually irrelevant. What matters is that he does it.
Yes, you pay great attention, for instance. I think, you know, All's Well Ends Well. You say, you know, the characters are completely uninteresting, but it's about mechanism and about plot as
yes.
These contraptions.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Shakespeare is a plot-first writer rather than a character-first writer. And I think that's probably, in some ways, relates to that larger question of agency. What makes the things happen that happen? It's completely natural to us in the 21st century to think character does. We do. You know, it's all, you know, our history is the history of great men. And, you know, that's what's important. I'm not sure that's as available as an explanatory framework for Shakespeare, but I also think he's not quite so interested in that. He is interested in story arcs and narratives, and they have an energy of their own.
Well, genre is a huge thing. I mean, you've got some lovely little sort of zingers of various aphorisms. I mean, we have, you know, Henry IV Part One, you call a history play that would prefer not to be. You've got, you say, Hamlet is a belated history play. Julius Caesar is part history, part tragedy. You see Winter's Tale as a comedy wrenched out of a tragedy. I mean, do you think Shakespeare's, I mean, we understand the genres, and obviously the Folio said, you know, there's histories, there's tragedies, there's comedies, and subsequently we've said, well, there are problem plays, you know, there's all. Do we think Shakespeare thought about genre in that same way, if you like, that we do now?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a really great question, because I don't think that genre theory is as well developed or is as important to Shakespeare. We know those Folio divisions are posthumous, so we don't know whether Shakespeare would have thought that's a good division. The history play is an interesting genre because it seems less about a shape, which is what we tend to think genre is, and more about content. So you can have comic histories ending in, you know, marriage or something. You can have more tragic histories around.
So presumably there aren't classical antecedents.
There are no classical antecedents. Yeah, that's right. So it's a place. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a place where genre seems a little bit more up for grabs. But we can certainly see Shakespeare, I think, experimenting with genres.
So Othello is kind of essentially a comedy. I think that was really interesting. Or at least he uses these comic.
Absolutely uses comic tropes. Uses the idea of a marriage, the idea that love might be the motor for tragedy, that the idea that in comedy brings about a happy ending, which is that we are more ourselves in groups or in couples or in communities. That seems to be what comedy says. We are social animals, and that's what a happy ending would be. It's less a kind of romantic ending and more a kind of communal one. Tragedies seem to say we are most ourselves, and it's not a pretty sight when we're on our own. And Othello makes a tragedy out of that comic incompleteness, because the fact that Othello is incomplete, has gone along with the kind of romantic idea that is incomplete without Desdemona, is a sort of fatal wound for him, and you know that's where it all goes wrong. So I am really interested in how those comedies turn into tragedies, and how at the end of his career Shakespeare's very clearly thinking about how you could flex those boundaries, paste one onto the end of another. He's doing that under the influence of the fashion for tragicomedy, which John Fletcher is big in.
Something that feeds into that question, I think, is this one of, as you describe it, his having his foot on both sides of these divides, of a sort of medieval worldview and a one, because predetermination, fate or grace in a kind of Puritan worldview, obviously is, you know, one of the characteristics of classical tragedy, isn't it? And yet you've got these classic speeches, you know, the fault is not in our stars, but with us. I've got that wrong, the wrong way around, haven't I? But the argument, I think you also got Edmund in Lear saying, you know, it's not divine intervention, it's not the spheres, it's not the stars, it's...
Yes.
You know, it's what we do,
yes,
and human moral agency.
Yeah.
Shakespeare seems to sort of straddle both sides of the divide.
He absolutely does, yeah. And I think Edmund's a really good example. So Edmund in the play is called, in all the early printings of the play, is called Bastard. That's his speech prefix, that's his name in the stage directions. That's really his name in the play. And so even as he is saying, you know, we make our own fates, we are our own people, you know, he's saying it from the mouthpiece of being an absolute type character. You know, he's a bastard in a modern and an early modern sense, which completely explains his malevolence. So that seems a really nice example of how Shakespeare gives a character a speech about human possibility and human self-realization, but sort of curtails it by saying and this dramatic or social type is the person who's going to deliver it. So I think often these moments of apparent human motivation and agency in the world are undercut by the context, and I think that is a really fascinating...
Do you ever feel him coming down on one side or the other?
I think you can make him come down on one side or the other, and I think there's been a long history of trying to do that, a long history, for example, of setting Julius Caesar in a context and with a costuming that makes it clear, yes, Caesar is a tyrant and these people are freedom fighters or defenders of the Republic, or, you know, Caesar is an authority and these are terrorists, you know, but their attempts to clarify by analogy. But I think that play is not, that doesn't really come down on one side or the other. And I do think that Shakespeare learning, I became really interested in this technique that was a big part of humanist education. Erasmus recommends it, and it was rolled out in grammar schools like the Stratford Grammar School. This idea that what you do with your classical education is to try to look at situations from the other side, to write a part for someone who isn't speaking, to write Dido's lament when Aeneas has left, or, you know, one of the things that's not there, but that you've got some of the raw materials for.
That's the classical rhetoric thing. Utramque partem,
yeah, from the other side or from both sides. And that seems to have been inadvertently a very, very good training for playwrights, because it does give you a sense that there's always another voice in the conversation. And Shakespeare is really good at giving those moments that are in excess of what's required, actually, for strict plotting, and that do tend to give us a sense of sympathy. And that will be an argument for, you know, gestures towards those rounded or more interior characters that I was arguing
against before.
But is there any...
any danger that this idea of Shakespeare as a kind of, I don't know, vanishing point of negative capability, a figure who can encompass every opposite, is itself a sort of a historical, asegetic kind of projection from an age that kind of values indeterminacy? I mean, you know, reading him historically in his own age, would people actually, you know, he's playing with these ideas, but his basic framework is X.
Well, I can see that writing a book in 2019, which says this is somebody who can see both sides of difficult questions. I mean, that's a very compelling... I mean, I can see why I might have done that. And I can see that you know, in 5 years' time, that might be even clearer to me that my own sense of Shakespeare is very much a product of now, and it's the Shakespeare that, or the thinker that perhaps we need, who is not on one side of a binary like all of the rest of us. So, I mean, I do see that that's ahistorical. I guess my larger point about Shakespeare is that we should be ahistorical. There's some things we can learn from the historical context, and there are some things that many better historians than me have done really brilliantly. Jim Shapiro's work is absolutely fantastic about thinking what did Shakespeare mean then and what did he get from then. And I suppose I'm trying to give permission in a way to say, actually, Shakespeare has changed, as we all have, from then. And what we think now is as relevant or as permitted by the plays as those earlier readings.
Keeps him alive a bit as well. I mean,
absolutely keeps him alive, yeah.
I remember being, I think it was Simon Russell Beale's production, seeing Hamlet, and they staged it in a way that made it very, you know, the Christian aspect of that play, you know, the idea that people were really, really frightened of going to hell was something I completely sort of missed in my schoolboy reading of the plays. And you draw attention to something which I think Stephen Greenblatt explores at more length, that, you know, old Hamlet is a ghost, and he's saying, you know, I'm in purgatory, which is a, you know, Catholic notion. And there's, I mean, this argument about how, you know, was Shakespeare a recusant Catholic is not one for us to really explore here, but was it just a mistake that he put what appear to be two kind of semi-incompatible religious schemes into Hamlet?
Well, I mean, one argument could be by putting those incompatible schemes or those versions of religious understanding, which are at absolute loggerheads in the period, that is an emblem of the theatre as this both sides of the question kind of space, that only in the theatre could a Catholic ghost encounter a Protestant graduate of Wittenberg University, Luther's University, and that, you know, maybe that is a sense that it's not an entirely modern projection onto the plays to see them as kind of balanced. I don't know whether it's a mistake, although I do think Shakespeare makes mistakes, but I think you could argue that it registers the kind of impossibility of being a man of the first Reformation generations, where, I mean, Stephen Greenblatt is absolutely brilliant on this, where we, you know, like Hamlet, Shakespeare is a Protestant son haunted by a Catholic father, and that, but perhaps that's a generational point. That's everybody was probably. Everybody, you know, everybody in that new generation suffered this great breach from the generations that had gone before them because of the change in religion.
Was it even worse than the Brexit conversation in our own generation?
Even worse than the Brexit conversation, yeah, a sense of being either side of a divide, of an unbridgeable divide, but perhaps a divide which Shakespeare wanted to think was possible to bridge in the theatre. Just because there are lots of ways that Hamlet, when I was writing about Hamlet, I wanted, in a way, to counter the sense that Hamlet is all about the modern and that it looks forward and anticipates things that come later, and instead to try and think about all the ways in which it's quite a retrospective, mournful, melancholy past kind of a play. And religion was one of those. But theatre is another one. I mean, one of the things that's preserved in Hamlet is an older model of what theatre might be like, and that too seems quite nostalgic.
Yeah. It's very interesting to me to read it. You're saying that in sort of tragedy Top of the Pops, Hamlet was the 19th century's pinnacle of the tragedy, and
yes,
they didn't really like Lear.
Yep.
And that in the 20th century, suddenly King Lear was the pinnacle of Shakespeare's tragedies.
Yeah. You know, I think the people who enjoyed Shakespeare in the 19th century saw themselves in this clever, troubled, melancholy sense of loss kind of Hamlet figure, and it's clear that a century that could give us, you know, Passchendaele and Hiroshima and Auschwitz and all those terrible things understood King Lear as a much less comfortable view of what we can do to each other. Humanity must perforce prey upon itself like monsters of the deep. I mean, it's really the man's inhumanity to man kind of argument. Yeah, so Lear became the great play for the 20th century. I think so far there's a move to Othello as a 21st century play, as again a kind of Islamic Christian battleground seems one of our crucial kind
well,
of axes.
Moore becomes a kind of huge quibble. I mean, not within the play, but outside it, doesn't
it? Yeah, completely. So Moore, it seems that for the early 17th century, the dominant meaning of Moore was Muslim, was a religious meaning and only an ethnic one secondarily, and also a geographical one about the region of North Africa. So that's a region which, of course, has become, you know, hugely politicised again about Mediterranean travel and Mediterranean power struggles and so on. And Cyprus, we see, you know, one of the great setting of Othello, still divided, still the landing and takeoff refueling point for the, you know, planes going to the Middle East and, you know, going to Syria and those kinds of things. You know, this is still a hot spot sort of battleground. And I think the play has come back into that in some ways and come back into the kind of racialized debates, particularly in the American classroom. So maybe the 21st century play will be Othello. Maybe we'll have moved Hamlet, King Lear, Othello.
I was fascinated to move actually briefly back to Hamlet because it's a good example. You pick up in, at different points in the book on points at which Shakespeare gives characters the same name or similar ones, you know, which obviously for somebody who's using sort of stage, from a point of view of stagecraft, that often looks a bit, you know, why would he give the characters the same name? That's an ineptitude. Why does he give several characters the same name within a play?
It's
I mean, everything
really,
from Jacques,
yeah,
you know,
Jacques in As You Like It, I think, is a really interesting example. So we've got this melancholy courtier, all the world's a stage kind of figure in As You Like It. And then right at the last minute in the play, the previously unseen third son of Roland Du Bois turns up, and he too is called Jacques. And you think, you know, what on earth has happened? I mean, it seems part to me in As You Like It of the sense that the play world is actually disintegrating. Where did that lioness come from? Who's you know, seen under about to attack somebody under a tree? That's not the forest we've been in, which has seemed a much more English pastoral kind of a place. I think the play is saying, you know, it's time to go home. It's all going a little bit pear-shaped here. It's not quite as Edenic as it seemed. Let's go back. Actually, we've done all we can here. Let's go back to court. So I think there is a feeling of things coming unstitched, and that happens right at the end of As You Like It. In Hamlet, which is not far away from it in date, it's at the beginning that the overlap in names is really compelling.
And
the first,
you say Fortinbras as well. His
yeah, that's right.
Fortinbras, so,
that's right. Just in case we don't get it. I think it is, you know, so good they did it twice. Yeah. The first Hamlet we hear about is actually Old Hamlet. And it's interesting to think, although he's not called old, that maybe our Hamlet is young Hamlet, or, you know, Hamlet Junior, Hamlet the Second. You know, it is all of those titles give a sense perhaps of being overshadowed by the past or having a more important father than the son. So there are ways that captures Hamlet's sort of psychic experience. I guess if you were to say this is a man haunted by his father, you wouldn't necessarily feel you had to have a ghost come on to help us understand that. And the naming, which is unique to Shakespeare, it's not in the sources, does seem to emphasise that.
Another thing you do that's textual about, you say the Midsummer Night's Dream, lovely Midsummer Night's Dream, which we've all seen our children trotting around being fairies. It shouldn't be performed by children. It's filthy.
It is, I'm afraid. It's absolutely filthy. You heard it here. There's a wonderful Elizabethan illustration of Puck, Robin Goodfellow, dancing around with sort of furry legs and cloven feet and a huge phallus. I mean, this is a fertility symbol. This is a naughty, highly sexualized. Fairies for the Elizabethans were very, very sort of sexualized. That's why the fairy changeling kind of motif was not just about tripping around and swapping things in the cradle. It was about bed tricks and taking the place of the rightful sexual partner and fathering children in these different places. So there's an awful lot, I think, in Midsummer Night's Dream that we have sort of erased because of the Victorian sense that this is a play of the nursery and that this is a play that's sort of
and the fairies,
suitable for children.
The Victorians saw fairies like the sort of Cottingley fairies, the little butterfly things.
Yes, that's right. Images of innocence and, you know, smallness and so on. I mean, actually, the fairies were almost certainly doubled with the rude mechanicals. These are sort of fairies in hobnail boots in the play. They're big, fully human, sort of grown-up creatures. And things like, you know, Titania's bower, the trick that's played on Titania, that she will fall in love with Bottom with his ass's head. I mean, that seems to be a trick about bestiality, a sense, a sort of, you know, rather sort of indecorous questions about how much of the rest of his body is on this kind of scale.
There is even a donkey joke in there.
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think Titania takes Bottom to her bower to stroke his ears, as she does in so many illustrations. I don't think that that is the humiliation which would make her give up the changeling boy, which is Oberon's claim on her. So, yeah, I think it's a play which... I wanted to suggest that lots of books about Shakespeare, lots of books that try to make Shakespeare perhaps a little bit more approachable tend to be aimed at children and people doing exams. So by definition, they tend to kind of move away from some of this material. And I wanted to think about a book for grown-ups which could enjoy this more grown-up version of the play.
Was it the Victorians who got Shakespeare most wrong, do you think, or who most aggressively interpolated their version?
I think we've probably always done it, actually, and it's a little bit unfair to say for me to say that the Victorians got the Shakespeare wrong. They've invented and projected and filled out those gaps in the way that they wanted to and needed to, and that was part of establishing Shakespeare as suitable for children and suitable for school. We get the first school teaching of Shakespeare, really, in that
century.
Would
you not teach him at school?
I've seen some absolutely brilliant Shakespeare lessons in classrooms, and I think teachers do a great job with it. I don't meet many people who say my light bulb moment about Shakespeare was at school. And I meet an awful lot of people who say I didn't get Shakespeare until I've started to come to the theatre later or I've started to do something. So I'm not sure that... I don't think that's because it's been badly taught. I think it's probably because Shakespeare has kind of lots of stuff about experience and stuff that maybe children just don't have.
You also describe very bravely that moment during Act 4 when you're kind of nodding off.
So boring, and you're always just trying to look at your watch, and it's then there's an awful moment where you think, oh, 20 past 9, how can it be? Haven't we all done that?
So why is there a boring bit in Act 4? Is that simply a dramatic failing on Shakespeare?
I think it possibly is a dramatic failing on Shakespeare. I do not think Shakespeare is very good at Act 4. I think Shakespeare is really good at setup and really good at resolution. And then sometimes there's a sort of treading water bit where really you're just waiting for it to be time to resolve. And sometimes that... I think that really casts a kind of static feeling over the play. So my exhibit A, and that would be As You Like It, which has a setup and a conclusion and then an interminable amount of sort of singing and shepherds kind of arguing, and nothing really happens. There's nothing to do in the in between. Or Hamlet going off to England and then being, you know, the pirates coming. I mean, what somebody should have said to him, actually, you know...
What, cut to the bit with the skull.
Exactly. You know, he just needs to be away for it. But we don't... This has gone awry somehow. So, yeah, I do think that, and I would like to see... I like to see Shakespeare productions which are intelligently cut. I think a two-hour Shakespeare can often be really excellent without an interval, that you get a kind of powerful narrative out of that. And I think that most three-and-a-half-hour Shakespeares feel about an hour too long to me. That's not always the case, but I think we do all. There is a slightly Emperor's New Clothes. We're not allowed to say that.
Can I ask why you chose the plays you did? Because I should say for the listeners who haven't yet bought the book, you have a sort of brief introduction and a brief conclusion, but otherwise it's a sort of play-by-play account. Mm. But you've chosen, what, 25 or 30 plays?
Yeah, 20, just 20.
Just 20 plays?
Yeah.
What made you choose the ones you did? For example, you know, I read your piece on 1 Henry IV and thought, I need to read about the rest of the Henriad in the arc, you know. Mm. What made you jump back and forth, and what made you pick the ones you did and exclude the ones you did?
Yeah, a combination of sort of an active choice and, I guess, a sort of happenstance. So the plays are in chronological order, so I try and give some sense. This is where things come in Shakespeare's career. This is how, you know, the Henriad is not... as we sometimes call the two parts of Henry IV and Henry V, maybe Richard II as well. That's not a project for Shakespeare of, you know, a two-year writing period. It's a more occasional set of plays, and I think by breaking it up chronologically, you see that. I tried to write about plays that people might be going to see, though most of them are more commonly performed ones I did, and I tried to write about a range of genres. And I tried to write about plays where I thought I had something to say which could review a larger critical history on that play and perhaps maybe point it in a particular direction. So I didn't actually write about As You Like It. I don't really like it, not very As You Like It, not very much. And I thought that would be a less, you know, just a less useful kind of chapter to write. So there are some things I'm sorry I missed out. I'm sorry I missed out Henry V, which I would have liked to have written about. I'm sorry I missed out some of my real favourites because I thought perhaps nobody is very interested in them, like Pericles, which is a play I find really, really fascinating, but I didn't write about.
So you have a mixture of greatest hits and faves.
Yeah.
And you put The Tempest at the end, though, as you say, originally, which I hadn't clocked, not being a sufficiently well-read Shakespearean, The Tempest was actually at the beginning.
Yeah, it's right at the beginning of the first folio. Yeah. It looks as if the first folio, which is the collection of 36 plays published in 1623, it looks as if it's being front-loaded to stress plays which have not previously been published. There is an economic problem about the first folio, which is that if you're keen on Shakespeare, you've already bought half of these plays. And we know from those kinds of packaged-up compilations, it's really annoying to rebuy something you've already got in order to get some new stuff. So the folio seems to have front-loaded perhaps the most recent, but also things that have not been published before, and that explains the order. Perhaps.
But did that mean that for some time scholars thought it was an early play?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a really good example of how what you expect to find, you do find. So now we think it's Shakespeare's last solo play or comes from the very end of his career. We see its brevity and it's the ways in which it condenses themes as a sort of summation and a wise late style. When it was thought to be an early play, these were all thought to be germs of ideas that Shakespeare would go on to develop further. And you can see how, the framework that you put on the plays already, you know, predisposes what you're likely to discover.
So I should just end by asking, do you have an absolute favourite? Or any that you suspect encapsulate a transcendental human truth? just a pour all over your nose.
That's right. Theory. Really, yeah, exactly. Secretly. Secretly. Is the microphone off? Now yeah, I'll exactly. Tell you about the transcendent human truth. I don't think I do have an absolute favourite. One of the things that's great about Shakespeare as something which is alive in the theatre and in adaptation is that you can have these plays refreshed for you in some quite different ways. I had the great privilege of reading the novelist Mark Haddon's retake on Pericles quite recently. That book's going to be out later this year. And that has really sent me back to Pericles in some really fabulous ways. So I think one of the reasons, you know, back to that question, our over-investment in Shakespeare, one of the wonderful consequences of that is you can keep getting a kind of refreshed Shakespeare back to you, which makes you see them differently. And I hope my book has maybe done a tiny bit of that.
Thank you. This was Shakespeare. This is Shakespeare, and Shakespeare will carry on.
Thank you.
Emma Smith, thank you very much. You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. I very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.